Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Insider, brought to you, just for a change, by Vanishing Ink. Today, we've got somebody on the line all the way from that there New York, Harvard graduate, hugely busy stand-up, multiple award winner, including the Andy Kaufman Award for Creativity and Originality, as seen on AGT, Conan, Comedy Central, Brain Games, star of The Illusionist on Broadway, the most requested performer at Monday Night Magic, regular at the Magic Castle, the one, the only, Harrison Greenbaum. Harrison, how are you this afternoon?
Thank you so much for having me. And it is true, I have been eliminated from many reality television shows. I'm getting very good at it.
You're an expert. You could give lessons, man.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a 30-minute show, so there's no time for pleasantries, Harrison. What's your origin story? You have 19 seconds.
Bit by a radioactive magician, gained magical superpowers, joined the magician equivalent of the Avengers.
Perfect. You studied psychology and English at Harvard, which isn't a question, but it's just a good fact. Whilst at Harvard, you started the Stand-Up Comic Society. Harvard sucks. Did you get into trouble for the name?
A little bit. I mean, well, it was funny because when we were coming up with the name, we hit upon Harvard sucks, and we thought that was hilarious as college students. So when we submitted the application to the dean's office, we always wrote it out full form so that sure. They never saw the acronym. And then after we submitted the paperwork, I get an email from the dean saying, hey, we need to talk to you. Can you come into the office? And I was like, oh, God. So I come in and they're like, yeah, the name doesn't work. And we're like, oh, they got us. And they're like, yeah, you're an undergrad institution. So you have to be the Harvard College Stand-Up Comic Society. And I was like, okay, I'm happy to be Harvard College sucks. And I walked out. I was like, oh, my God, they don't know. And several years, at my fifth year college reunion, one of the deans came up to me and was like, while you were a student, we officially were angry at you. But unofficially, that was like one of the best pranks that has ever been pulled on our office.
You have performed thousands and thousands of stand-up shows in New York. How many gigs do you do a year?
I do generally between 600 or 700 shows a year. So it's usually like two or three shows a night every night.
Oh, my gosh. So is that why, do you think that, because a lot of magicians that I talk to talk about flight time, and is that what it is? That's why you're as confident and as sharp and as good as you are, just because you never stop doing it?
Well, I think especially for comedy, like, and thank you for the compliments. Don't stop. Those are great. I'll happily take all of them. But I think in terms of comedy magic in particular, you know, the only way to get funny is to do those jokes in front of people. Like, a joke is not funny until an audience is laughing at it. So, you know, there's only so much you can do alone in your apartment. You have to get it out there and test it in front of people. And I like to get in front of the audience and, you know, work word by word through jokes. Sometimes changing the to an makes a difference. And, you know, it's editing that joke down until it's, you know, as short as possible and packs the most punch. So that's a process that only happens in front of the audience. There's like a famous comedian who had a quote about, in comedy, the instrument is the audience. So like in every other art form, like if you're a saxophone player, the saxophone is your instrument. If you're a singer, it's your voice. But in comedy, it's the audience. So I can't practice alone in my apartment. I have to get up in front of people. So you got to get up. You got to get those reps.
Sure. So are you, if you're doing three or four shows a night, what's your review process and your material? Are you recording every show and then listening back to it or remembering the bits that hit?
Yeah, I mean, I record every single show. I take my iPhone and I stick it on the stool. And then right after I get off stage, I put little notations in the file name of things that were different or changed, so I know to look at those. And then sometimes it's literally in the cab or on the subway to the next gig, I'm listening to that recording of the show did to listen back and see if those tweaks worked. And, you know, sometimes, you know, a really fun Friday or Saturday night in New York City could be 6-7 shows. I think my record is 10. So you can really start a night with an idea of a joke and end with something that's a lot more workable.
Sure. What do you prefer, pure stand-up comedy or comedy magic?
I love them both equally, which is, I think, how every mother answers the question about their children. I don't know why I became the mother. I could have said father. But I'm the mom now.
Okay, we can roll with that. It's fine.
I think, you know, I always say, like, when I'm doing a lot of stand-up, all I want to do is magic. And when I'm doing a lot of magic, all I want to do is stand-up. I do really feel like I guess the analogy, maybe they're like peanut butter and jelly or peanut butter and chocolate, and they're both delicious in their own right. And then when you combine them, it creates this new thing. So I love both. I mean, I started out as a magician. I was 5 years old when I saw my first magic trick. And I've loved magic for my entire life. And I'm so magic is a very big part of my life. So it's something that will always be there. And stand-up is cool, too. Stand-up is such like a blood sport. It's like jumping out of a plane. And there's the huge adrenaline rush of just being there with your words. So when I finally figured out how to sort of combine them in a unique way, I think that for me has been my passion and touring the because my magic show is really a stand-up magic show. It's a stand-up comedy magic show. So I feel like they're not – I'm really doing both. So I've sort of – I don't know if it's a cop-out, but I found – figured out a way to do both at the same time, which has been kind of cool.
Does the – do the other comics in the New York magic scene frown upon the fact that you do magic as well? Because I know in London a lot of the pure – stand-ups, I think, oh, it's like it's prop stuff, he's relying on the magic. Is that the same in New York or is it different?
Oh, I mean, I agree with them. I mean, I think a lot of the gripes that comics have with magicians are very well earned, because most comedy magicians aren't writing their own material. Most of them are buying material, they're doing something that's based on something else. There's rules that comedians follow that magicians still don't, which is why I give a lecture called You Are All Terrible all around the world. Uh-huh. And the thesis is that every other art form creates their art by coming up with an idea and then figuring out how to express it. Just like a comedian, they're like, I want to make a joke about this, so how do you make it funny? Magicians don't do that. They don't have an idea and then say, how do we make it magical? They buy a trick and then they try to jam it into their act. So you have to look at the tricks more as tools as opposed to these idea springboards. But I think for my personal thing, like when I'm at the Comedy Cellar, which is like one of the best clubs in the world, and it's just such a joy to perform there and an honor. The best comics in the world are performing there. I'm doing pure stand-up there, so they know that I have the ability to do pure stand-up. So when I bring my magic show to the Village Underground as the show, they're watching it with the – some of them didn't even know I did magic for a very long time. Some of them still don't know. So I've earned the street cred as a stand-up comedian. So when I add magic, they know that I'm adding it. I'm not using it to make up for a lack of anything else.
Right.
Cause that's the old cliche. The comedy magicians are bad at comedy and bad at magic. So they put it together. So I think by doing, you know, like Conan, it was a pure stand-up set. Mm-hmm. I consciously wanted to put stuff out there that's pure stand-up. So people know that the stand-up and the comedy that I'm doing in my act comes from a real place, from the same place that like my idols, you know, Carlin and Pryor and all those people, in addition to my magic idols. It's all sort of a jamming together.
Sure. What do you love about stand-up?
I love the free booze. And no, I don't. I never drink before I go on. And I rarely drink now after. But you know what? Once in a while, a free jalapeno popper. What a bonus. I love making people laugh. I love getting on stage. And there's just, first of all, it's just you and a microphone. So it's very raw. And it's one of those things where I guess it's very high risk, high reward. Uh-huh. So when it's bad, it's very bad. When stand-up comedy is bad, it's the worst. I used to joke that like when you're doing magic, even if you're a bad magician, if you shoot fire out of your butt, like people are gonna be like, whoa, I've never seen the fire butt trick. Like, wow. So you could be a bad magician, but you did the fire butt thing. So people are still gonna walk home and go, remember when that fire came out of his butt? Like, oh my God, that was, what an incredible thing. So I think comedy doesn't have that. It's either the jokes are funny and you're funny or you're not.
Right.
So it's much more immediate and visceral in that way. But that's why I like working on both. So every time you get into the woods, you know, working on a prop that you're inventing or crafting for a trick, sometimes it's nice to then just go to my roof and just write and work on jokes, which feels a lot less concrete in a way. Sure. And then vice versa.
Sure. You've got quite a couple of Facebook video series, and I've been watching them this afternoon. What did it feel like when Todd Robbins pushed a nail into your head in the Coney Island episode?
It felt good. No, can you imagine? It's like, it's the greatest thing. I do it. It's my, I found my kink. That would be a weird way to find it out.
Yeah,
I've known Todd since I was a kid. I was going to Monday Night Magic when I was a kid, and I looked up to these guys. I still look up to these guys. So Todd's somebody I've always admired quite a bit. And when I was pitching the pilot of the series, we wanted to do something that was sort of local to New York, so we could test the idea of this travel show and what the tone would look like, what the episodes would look like. So we were like, what is if we asked Todd to teach me stuff in Coney Island? Because Coney Island is off the beaten path of New York. Mm-hmm. And I love Coney Island. It's one of my favorite places. And I was like, I've never done like the blockhead. And I asked Todd, I was backstage, I was about to headline Monday Night Magic. I think he was hosting, but we were both backstage. And I was like, is it possible to teach that, you know, in a reasonable length of time, like on camera? And he was like, oh yeah, we could totally do it. And it was insane. I definitely a feeling I did not expect. I was able to breathe a lot better for like 3 days, which was great. I was like, I think I actually have to do this on the reg. But yeah, that the nail was not bad. Once it went in and I got used to it, it was great. The fire eating always scares the crap out of me.
Sure.
And sword swallowing, holy moly. I mean, I guess people thought based on my voice that I would be able to do it very easily. But it was hard. I did not get it down. We cut for time the sword swallowing attempts. That was in the first edit. The director's cut, I guess. But yeah, we tried sword swallowing and after like, I think it was like 17, there's like tears coming down my face. I'm like gagging. Oh, it looks awful. And he was like, you get like a certain number of times before your body, it's diminishing returns. Your body is, as soon as the sword gets near it, your body tenses up and is like, no, definitely not. Uh-huh. So he's like, we can try it a couple times, but if you get locked up, you might not get a sword down today.
Sure. Tell us about the series and how it got started.
I was reached out to by USTOA, the United States Tour Operators Association. And they initially were going to hire me to do a gig, and we were talking, and they mentioned that they were developing their content for the year. And I mentioned I have a background in producing stuff. I'm a huge whore. Can I say that? I don't know.
I reckon.
Bleep, beep. Wait, I'll restart that. I'll restart that. I was initially contacted by the United States Tour Operators Association, the USTOA, and they wanted to hire me for a gig. They had seen me, I think, on America's Got Talent. But I had mentioned my production background because I say yes to everything, for better or for worse. But I was the warm-up comic for Katie Couric's talk show, so I made many housewives from New Jersey happy. And that led to a job in the same building at ABC. I was producing a show called Would You Fall for That, which the network did not because it was not renewed. But those were all things that were contributing to my knowledge of sort of what goes on behind the camera of a show. Sure. So I was producing that. I produced a show for VH1. And so I mentioned my production background as well. And it just kind of gelled between USTOA and me that we should try this show. Because they were really looking to add comedy into their mix. It was great. I mean, my dream was, I think everybody dreams of hosting like a food show or a travel show. Uh-huh. And I was basically able to do both. So it's amazing. And the director of photography, an editor is Ruben Moreland, who is also a great magician in his own right. And somebody I met through Magic Camp. So there was that magic thread that kind of ties everything together.
So yeah, I was going to go there later, but we'll go there now. As you mentioned it, you went to Magic Camp and then went back to be a counselor there. How important do you think it is to guide the next generation of magicians? What do you get out of going back there?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important to me. This will be my 20th year coming up of Magic Camp, which is crazy. But it changed my life. I mean, Magic Camp, I would not be where I am. And I would not be able to do what I do without Magic Camp. So I look at all the mentors, and that's the beauty of magic. Comedy can be very harsh. There's usually nobody takes you under your wing, like, I'm going to teach you how to do comedy, kid. they just throw you out to the wolves. But in magic, you can be a kid and there'll be these, you know, these mentors, people who actually like are really like the best magicians in the world will help you, which is nuts. And I was very fortunate. And so I always try to pay it forward and be very, very helpful. And very regularly I'll get emails from kids who are like, I want to do stand-up, hear my jokes. And I'm like, oh God, I've just ruined another life. But we have more people throwing away their educations to be performers. there is a fraternity / sorority in magic that I think is very cool. And there's a reason most of my best friends are magicians.
You appeared on AGT. When you got the call, how tricky a decision was it to say yes? Because it's so hard for a comedian to stand out in such a short set.
Yeah, I mean, the reality shows are kind of like jury duty in that I feel like you're compelled to do it every 6 years. It doesn't make it any more fun. It's always a calculation. You know, one of my friends who's a comedian, she was like, you got to take some risks. Because I was playing things a little bit close to the vest. She's like, you got to take a chance. And so when that thing came, I was like, all right, it's a little bit of a roll of the dice, but I'm as prepped as I could humanly be for this kind of show in terms of I've done high pressure performances all the time. Mm-hmm. Walking out, as long as I concentrate on what I know, which is how to walk on the stage, hit the mark, and do stand up and make the audience in the room laugh, then I'm just going to have to see how the rest of how the dice roll.
Right.
And fortunately, it paid off, and the judges were great. But yeah, it's a tough process. Those reality shows are, you know, in many ways, the judges are the stars, and you're the set. Mm-hmm. You're the prop. But you're doing your best to showcase what you can and get it out in front of them. And the judges were very kind to me, so I appreciate it.
How did the experience compare to other TV stuff that you've done, like Conan?
Yeah, I mean, so Conan was a joy to do. I think with a reality show, it kind of doesn't matter whether you do good or bad,
right?
Whether you do poorly or well, because if you do poorly, that's also good television for a reality show about, you know, a competition. With Conan, they're booking you because they really like you, and all they want you to do is succeed. That's their goal. So it's definitely you definitely feel a lot more attention and love in that sense, because their whole goal is to make you look like $1 million when you walk out on that stage at Conan. And they were so cool. Like, they approved my set, so I knew exactly what jokes I was going to do. And the booker was like, all right, you're going to do those jokes. And if the set goes a little bit long because they're clapping or applauding a lot or laughing a lot, he's like, that's a good thing. Don't worry about it. Have to cut from earlier in the show to make sure your set fits, we will do it. So just do the best set you can and have a great time, which is amazing. Because some other shows won't do that. Some shows will say, if you get too many applause breaks or too many laughs and that makes your set longer than expected, you're going to have to cut something.
Yeah, try not to be too
they were very
funny.
Much like, no, don't do that. Yeah, 100%. They were like, no, do everything we approved and we'll figure out a way to make it work because our job is to make you look awesome.
Man, how lovely.
Yeah, it was great.
On the Brain Game, you debunked psychics. Did it feel... like initially when you were doing the readings, did it feel a little bit dirty when you were pretending to be psychic?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one thing that was very lucky. So the show that I produced for ABC called Would You Fall for That? Was a show where we use psychological principles and kind of use them to create fun, like hidden camera segments. So we were teaching psychology through like hidden camera comedy, which was... when I walked into the room to interview, it was like, oh, you're a magician, Harvard, and comedy. Like, this Venn diagram is perfect. Mm-hmm. But a bunch of the producers that they brought on later were people that had done Brain Games or were on, on break from Brain Games. So I became really friendly with these Brain Games producers. And those, by the way, some of those producers went on to help me with, not help me, they did, What's Your Problem? So What's Your Problem had a genesis with Brain Games producers. So that it's all connected. But the when Brain Game, once the Would You Fall for That was over, we had done a segment for that where we had our host be sort of a fake psychic of sorts. And he would give Barnum horoscopes. Mm-hmm. And then he would tell, and then at the end, we would say, all right, I would like to share one of our readings. Don't react, but I just want to share one of the readings because it was very meaningful. And he reads the whole reading and he says, raise your hand if that was your reading. And everybody raises their hand and everybody looks at each other and realizes what the gag is. But the way that host kind of let them off the hook and made them feel good about it, because it was very easy at that moment to be like, haha, you guys are stupid. You guys should have, we fooled you. We got you.
No.
And that's not at all what we were trying to do. And he gave this amazing speech where he was like, first of all, the only reason we were able to fool you is because you're smart. Mm-hmm. And second of all, what we've done, you know, everybody would have fallen for this. That's the whole point of this show, is that this is a psychological thing. So the fact that you're human means you would fall for this.
Right.
And what you're doing is really helping people. And so what you've done is really amazing and we really appreciate it. So he gave this great speech and I filed it away of like, this is the perfect way of doing sort of a hidden camera reveal and then making the person you've sort of punked feel good about it, because what because I never want somebody to feel bad. And like, as somebody who's been on reality shows where you're not sure whether they want you to look good or bad, I want to make sure if I'm the producer, I'm making my people look good and feel good and having a good time. So when we did Brain Games and we did the psychic thing, it was very important that at the end, once we revealed, by the way, I'm not a psychic, but you're on this educational show that's really going to help people. And what you showed was really amazing. And what, you know, we wanted to make sure that everybody involved felt good. So it was uneasy up until the break, but thanks to that previous training, I think I was able to make sure that everybody came away, I think, pretty happy.
How lovely. I was listening to an episode of my favorite other podcast, apart from this one, Reply All, where they were talking about the psychic operators in New York at the moment. And it's all kind of gone a bit crazy with so many of them doing it and the police not doing anything about it. Does that kind of thing, how does that make you feel? Does it annoy you?
Well, I mean, they're psychic, so they're always one step ahead. No. You know, I have a couple of jokes in my act about that. I mean, like, I have a joke about astrology now that I've been working on pretty hard. We live in a really weird time where, like, the president of America is a reality show game show host. Mm. So if people believe crystals have positive energies, in a way, you can't blame them.
Yeah.
Like, both of those ideas seem very ridiculous. You know, the prime minister of England can't find a comb. Uh-huh. That seems weird.
Yeah.
As magicians, we know how to take advantage of human psychology. That's our job. We know that's what we do. We manipulate the way people perceive reality in a way.
Sure.
We use it for good, I'd like to think, and there are always going to be people who use it for bad. And so it's sad and distressing, but it's not surprising.
Right. Tell us about the Friars Club and why you're a member.
The Friars Club, I was a member of it for a while, and I ran the New Directions Committee, which is like the Friars under 40. I'm a big old softie, and I love history. I think magicians are very good about keeping track of magic history. Mm. And so when I really shifted over to comedy, I wanted to make sure I had the same thing where, you know, you read books about the history of it, and you look up what the old greats were doing and all that kind of thing. So the Friars Club was always part of those histories. It was where all the Borscht Belt Catskills comedians would come and hang. And it really had its heyday when you had, you know, Buddy Hackett in the sauna making jokes. So that always very much appealed to me. And coincidentally, also not very far from my apartment. So that was also handy. Great. Nice to have a clubhouse near where you live. When I had the opportunity to join, I jumped on it, and I thought it was very cool to be part of that New York comedy history.
Tell us about your show, What Just Happened.
Yes, that's my baby. I've been working on it for way too long, over 10 years now. But it's one of those things where I always said, you know, I love magic, but I hate magicians. Not all of them. But I there were so many things wrong with magic, and that's what the lecture comes from, too. You know, this idea that people are essentially cover bands who think they're Beatles cover bands who think they're John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're doing somebody else's trick with somebody else's script, with somebody else's character. And then they're like, look how amazing I am. It's like, you're very good at copying.
Right.
You did a very good, there's a difference between drawing a comic book and then putting that comic book in front of you and then sketching what you see. There's a skill to that, but it's a very different skill. So the show sort of arose as a put your money where your mouth is type thing, where I was like, all right, well, if you think magic can be good, design the show that you would like to see.
Right.
And so that's what this show is me trying to design the comedy magic show that I would like to see. And so it's a lot of stand-up. It's all original jokes. It's all original material. Every trick I had to build or invent from the ground up. And create an 80-minute show that at the end of it, I'm usually a sweaty mess. That's how I know I did a good show. I'm a sweaty mess and I'm like James Brown and I need to put like a cape on me because I'm exhausted.
So with the tricks being all original, like every aspect, are there plots that you've looked at and improved upon or changed or made your own? Or is that, you mean absolutely everything in Magical is original in the show?
I mean, there's there are things that are basics and things there. I'm building on stuff just the way an artist doesn't have to invent paint every time. But like, yeah, every trick, I try to push it as far as it possibly can so that every trick is that if you see me do that trick, there's nobody else who's doing that trick in any way close to that.
How wonderful.
Sometimes that means inventing a totally new method or coming up with an entirely new presentation. Usually it's a combination of both. And a lot of that just comes because I come up with an idea for what I want to make magical. Like, ooh, it'd be really fun to play The Price is Right with the audience. And then I figure out how to insert magic into it.
Okay.
So the idea and the comedy is always informing the magical choices, which forces you to be original because all of a sudden you're like, oh, how do I... There's no trick that exists called the Price is Right trick.
Yeah, I have
to figure out what I can do to make that happen.
Yeah, unlike the hack who's just bought a trick and is shoehorning it into his thing. You come up with the idea first and then work out the trick afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Or like with the FU trick, that came up, started as a comedy script. I wrote the script for it because I was like, this would be really funny if this, and this happened.
Right.
And then I was like, oh, crap, I need to come up with a method.
I need a trick now.
I know what I want to happen, but since I am not a wizard, I need to develop a method for this. And so, you know, you try a million different methods and every trick, you know, that's one of the ways you can figure out if somebody actually came up with something is just ask them the story. Ask them the history of a trick. Any comedian who's written a joke will be able to tell you every time, like, this is when I came up with the idea. It was this situation. I was in this club probably when I first did it. And then there was a breakthrough because the joke used to be this way, but now it's this way. And it's the same thing for every magic trick in my act. I can show you there were so many different versions that led to the version that's currently in my show. Because there's always an evolution. Every trick takes years for me before I'm even remotely content with it.
Tell us about the State of the Magic Union speech performance lecture that you will be doing at the session in January. Roasts aren't really much of a thing in the UK. So what should people expect from your performance?
Yeah, I mean, definitely no kids. there's definitely a rating. It's for adults. Josh and Annie gave me the opportunity to do it in at Magi Fest. And it was a blast. Basically, every year, the biggest comedy festival in the world is called Just for Laughs. Mm-hmm. And it's in Montreal. And there's this amazing comic who gives a State of the Comedy Union, where he essentially roasts everything that's happened in stand-up comedy that year. And I always felt like there was a huge gap because there was no annual tradition for magic in a similar way. Because there's all these things that are happening and developments and feuds and TV shows and all these crazy things happening in the world of magic. And nobody is doing this annual roast. So when I pitched it to Josh and Andy, they were like, oh yeah, we really want that. And I have a background in roasting because I've done Roast Battle and I've been a judge on Roast Battle. If you're a child, please don't Google Harrison Greenbaum Roast Battle. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that and now they all are.
Yeah.
I know what you're doing, but stop it. Don't do it. But if you're an adult, though, do it. So I have a background in roasting. It's a fun, as a friar as well, being in the Friars Club, that's a very, you know, that's where a lot of the roast style comes from. So it's just really, really fun to sift through what's happened this year and try to come up with a comedic angle for each thing. So, you only roast the ones you love.
Really?
Give or take. I always say, I'm only roasting the ones I love with a few exceptions, but you're going to have to figure out which the ones those are.
Yeah, fair enough. Harrison, we're nearly out of time. We end with four quick questions. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Favorite movie?
Oh, no. My favorite movie is, these are supposed to be quick. And this is hard. The Lion King.
Okay. Favorite pizza topping?
Favorite pizza topping? I think mushrooms. I like mushrooms.
That's so weird, man. I've had no mushrooms for any episodes of this podcast. I've just done four.
Really?
No, wait. I've just done four in the last 2 days. Avner the Eccentric, Tina Leonard, Steve Reynolds, and now you. And all four of you have said mushrooms. There's some kind of mushroom trend happening, man.
Everybody said mushrooms?
Yeah, all four. I don't get it. Anyway.
I think that's the test of a good magician.
Maybe.
If you ask somebody what their favorite topping is and they said pepperoni, you're like, Chris Angel, get out of here.
Favorite person that makes music?
Ooh, I'm a big Broadway person, so it's like probably Stephen Sondheim.
Okay. And finally, who would you rather fight, 100 tiny Joshuas or one massive Andy?
Oh, boy. Yeah. That is... What would a massive Andy be? Like, he'd be 6 feet tall? I don't know. I can make that joke because we're friends. I think 100 tiny Joshes would just feel very fun. They would all have a story to tell about a prisoner. Well, I guess it would be 600 impossible things. Is that what the show would be? 600 very tiny impossible things. That sounds fun.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time, Harrison. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing you at the session in January.
Absolutely. Same here. Can't wait.